Hello, and welcome to Lament Configuration, a podcast about the shit that makes us sad. I'm horror author and film critic Gretchen Felker-Martin. With me is my co-host,
Julia Graffair. I'm a graphic novelist of horror and tragic romance erotica. I'm still doing that thing where I don't know how to... It's a terrible elevator pitch. The word erotica is so prissy to me. I hate it. Romance, I think people... Smut is cutesy too. I don't really like it. It's like the standard word for in fanfic. And so I've gotten a little desensitized to it, but I still find it... so many fandom terms are like baby talk.
Yeah.
Squick. I can't deal with squick. Like the concept of squick, I totally am like, I love, in the sense that like, there's this whole ethos of like, I don't like this. It's fine if you like it. But for me, it's going to turn me off and I can't be around it. You know, It's like a non-judgmental. That's the idea of squick anyway.
Right.
And I respect that, but I don't like to say that word. It feels so stupid.
It's in very my mouth. Baby-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I guess like, I don't know, whenever I refer to the stuff that I make, I just call it porn.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like porn to me, but it that feels like it also would give people the wrong idea. And of course, there are people who will be like, oh, no, it's not porn. It's so much more than that. Fuck you.
Yeah. Suck it.
Literally.
Yeah.
But people will say that about horror, too.
That's very true. One thing I just cannot fucking stand, and we've been through so many iterations of it now in the past 10 years, is every version of, like, this is elevated horror.
Boo.
Oh, just fucking get a machine to take over the arduous work of jerking yourself off that hard.
I'm not a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
Yes, it's exactly that. Ugh.
Fuckers. Not allowed.
I feel like if you don't want to be in the same category as Hellraiser, you're just irredeemable. You're a fucking loser.
Yep.
No excuse.
Tell us how you really feel.
I'm a very reserved person, and I would never employ harsh or judgmental language in explaining my opinion.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that with the podcast, we can help you to come out of your shell a little bit. Just like, begin to share some of yourself with the world.
Stop being such a blushing violet or drinking violet or whatever the fuck it is. Yeah, well, here's hoping.
Lucky episode 13, baby.
You want to do some questions?
Yeah, let's do them.
All right. This comes from Jardonis. Have you ever made or worked on something where the main reason was that you were just fueled by spite?
Probably to some extent, most things.
Yeah. I often feel a certain measure of, like, fuck you whenever I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think comes with the territory of being someone whose existence is resented by vast swaths of the population.
Right.
In some ways, I sort of see my whole career as, like, a chance to blow a raspberry at all of those people, even if I can't really do anything to them.
I wrote Black is the Color right after getting laid off in a way that I thought was really shitty, and still do. And the story, which begins with a sailor getting kind of surprise kicked off his boat and left in the middle of the ocean, was inspired by that experience. And I dedicated that book to, I think, to my boyfriend at the time and to Dylan Williams and to everyone who left me for dead,
which
I realize sounds melodramatic and people have made fun of that. Those are idiots. But I mean, that's like literally, that's what I felt had happened. And
it's unconscionable what they did to you. Like,
oh yeah, it's very bad. We don't have to talk about it.
Yeah.
After they laid me off, I never went back to having a day job, because I had been laid off several times and it was just too disruptive for my life as a single parent of a very small child, and it was just too much. So that book was my first work transitioning to being a cartoonist full time, and making it did kind of feel like, or I was working on it before then. Wait. Oh, that's right. Oh my God. Okay. So I started working on it when I got laid off from one place. And a couple of years later, right before the Fantagraphics edition came out, I got laid off from another place. Good Very job. Similar situation. So I was like, wait a minute, how does that timeline work? But yeah, so the second place that laid me off, that was my last full-time real people job. And much of the creation of it was fueled by spite.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain level of that that is both unavoidable and not unhealthy. Being angry with the people who force you to live in pain is good. You should feel that.
Right. I mean, the alternative was for me to lay down and die.
Right. I guess writing Ego Hominy Lupus, I don't know if it was primarily spiteful, but it was definitely a way for me to go over some specific things that I had been subjected to in a romantic relationship. And it felt to me like I was exposing the other person in what I hoped was a humiliating way. And that really kept me at the helm of the project when I was really, really, really mentally ill.
Mm.
To just be like, fuck you. Anyone could see if they saw the things that you did to me, how fucked up this was and how awful you were.
I think part of the process of writing about bad things that have happened to me is trying to figure out whether or not it's okay for me to be upset about them. Like, I have to put them into a slightly different context. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the things that people say in my books are things that people have said to me or things that I've said to them, or situations that are just like slightly shifted from the way that they happened, the setting has changed, or the objects in question have changed. And it's just an outgrowth of these little thought exercises that I'm always doing with myself of trying to recontextualize something until I can make sense of it. And, you know, Michael DeForge had a great tweet about 10 years ago. No, I think it really was like 7 years ago. That was, my comics hold up a mirror to society, and if you don't like what's reflected, then that's on you.
God love him.
I mean, he was being ironic, but like, seriously. Yeah, I know. people who have been depicted in my comics sometimes have been angry with the way that they recognized that it was about them and they didn't like it. And I try to be very fair. I think all my characters are very sympathetic. I think by creating a fictional representation of a person, you know, you make like a little doll of that person. You do work and like extend tenderness and sympathy to it. Like, it's a very loving thing to do for somebody that you don't like.
Yeah. you're bringing them into your heart.
And replacing them with somebody you like better, which you invented.
Right, just a version of them who is a little man that you're in charge of.
Uh-huh. And then you give him all the problems.
That really just, like, smooths the wrinkles out of a lot of people.
Turning them into a little man?
Yeah.
A tiny protagonist.
Just a little guy.
Yeah. Oh, but I don't want to give the idea that my work is too autobiographical. Like, there is also actual creative thought involved. And I'm saying this because occasionally a reviewer, gender unspecified, will credit me with writing work that is veiled autobiography and casting myself as the hero, drawing other conclusions about my psychology, who I am and what I want.
I have seen some of these interviews.
Yeah, I'll link them on the Discord if you remind me. I don't want to shame anybody. I appreciate everybody who writes about my work, even if you don't like it. I know a lot of thought goes into writing a review, and the thought matters more to me than whether or not you think it's good.
Yeah.
Attention is the currency.
Yes.
Not being liked.
Being disliked, I think, is, you know, it's sort of the inverse.
It can be very satisfying.
About. Yeah. It's like,
well, for you and me especially, I think we've talked about this before, because it feels validating. That's like, yes. It's part of our core identity.
Right. Like, oh, thank you for affirming
that. For agreeing with me that I'm unlikable.
Right. That I'm a miserable bitch. Thank you. Which I think is not uncommon for people who've been through things like what we've been through.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. And then there's also our friend, Justin Sharon, who writes the Richard Nixon account on Twitter. It's at Dick Nixon. Anyway, he had a great tweet a while back about being hated by the right people.
Yeah.
I've often said, if I don't make the church mad, I don't even know what I'm doing with my career.
Absolutely.
I would love to make the Pope have a coronary.
That's a pretty tall order. How are you going to come to the notice of the Pope?
I mean, I don't know, but I'll figure it out.
In the new Pope, John Malkovich Pope had audiences with Sharon Stone and Marilyn Manson.
Boy, that was a singularly ill-timed celebrity cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess all I need to do is get like controversial and famous, and then the Pope will have an audience with me.
Yeah, I was just like, let people look up your skirt in a movie.
Right. And I'll just shock him so badly that he dies on the spot.
I'm joking. That's a joke. Sharon Stone is a very talented actress.
Yes, she is.
I love her. Also, that movie is great.
Basic Instinct rules. She's so good in Casino. She's like the actress of the late 90s.
Yeah, she's perfect.
Fucking queen.
Yeah.
You want to move on to the next question?
Sure.
This comes from Hounds of Love. What are the most Gretchen and Julia places in the world?
Feels weird to say somewhere that I, like, haven't physically lived.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I, like, associate either of us with a place other than a house or an apartment.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a boring answer. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer this one, actually.
Okay. I guess, like, the basement room where we were born.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Do the podcast listeners know that?
I'm sure some of them do. Julia,
I mean, but we haven't mentioned it on the podcast, though.
Oh, we might not have. So Julia and I were actually born in the same hippie birthing center in the same little town in New Hampshire.
7 years apart.
And then we did not meet until I was in my late 20s.
That's right.
Which is impressive considering how tiny that part of the state is.
Uh-huh.
Although I'm sure we were at the same place more than once.
Oh, I'm sure. That's weird to think about.
It is weird. Very weird.
I wonder if I ever ran into Greg. I feel like I must have.
Yeah. Greg is another New Hampshire friend of ours who is just like, what a lovely human being.
Yeah, he's terrific. He's also a Twitter personality.
Yes. He's at Cat Beltane.
That's right.
And I believe his display name is Gregory Possum Botherer or some stripe. He changes it a lot.
I was like a fan of Greg's before we became friends on Twitter because he was one of my favorite Metafilter commenters.
Yes.
And then I think he got banned from Metafilter for making fun of Hillary Clinton or something. Oh, which great. Is really it's an object lesson in what is wrong with Metafilter these days.
Yeah, I've heard it has gotten very, 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 like, neo-lib.
Yeah, it really, like, I used to go on Metafilter all the time. And then after the 2016 election, or really during that election, it went so wild. I mean, there's always been, like, a lot of a predominantly upper middle class, white, liberal, Gen Xer predominant vibe. And it just, I hesitate to use the word toxic, but it became pretty obnoxious.
Ugh.
Yep. Still, I think Metafilter had the right idea in that you had to pay $5 to join. And you could read without joining, but if you wanted to comment, you had to pay $5 to sign up.
It's nice to, like, insist on a little bit of skin in the game.
Exactly. And they had 24-hour moderator coverage,
mm-hmm.
and they paid their moderators.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So there were people who were actually being paid to make sure that everybody behaved themselves on the site.
Rather than, like, a bunch of wage-enslaved drones sifting through piles of Nazi garbage on Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, also you can't post inline images. So
that's smart.
But yeah, I mean, the alternative is volunteers, and it just is so much work to keep a site that size running smoothly.
Yeah, moderating even a small online community is very difficult.
Yeah, it was so long since I had been a forum moderator, and then now I'm moderating all these Discords and all these interpersonal situations that I had forgotten that you have to deal with.
Feeling a little bit like Dr. Manhattan. I'm tired of these people.
Yeah. What is your favorite place to shop? That's what I'm asking you instead of what is the most Gretchen place.
My favorite place to shop? That's a good question.
What's your consumer identity?
You know, I mean, this is so fucking stereotypical. I love a good used bookstore.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I love to just...
Do you have a favorite used bookstore?
I do. My favorite used bookstore is Book Bear, which has an enormous chainsaw statue of a bear out front, like a chainsaw carving.
Nice. Where is it?
It's north of Worcester. I forget the name of the town in Massachusetts. And it's just huge. It's like two stories. There's a little annex off the main floor that's full of magazines.
Wow. And
yeah, they just have everything. It's so nice and it smells so good.
That sounds amazing.
Like sawdust, and a little bit of mildew, and I love it. I haven't been there in years, but I would love to go back. How about you? Where's your favorite place to shop?
Well, obviously I love a good thrift store. I think my favorite thrift store is the William Temple House in Portland, Oregon. I think it's still there. I looked it up recently and almost cried. I used to live right near there, so I would go there at least once a week. And it's just one of those weird little charity shop thrift stores. There is a Goodwill in the neighborhood also. It was like right on the border of a very rich neighborhood, so you would sometimes get designer clothes there and stuff, and that was really fun. But the William Temple House had more like weird stuff, handmade stuff, stuff from other countries, stuff that was very, very old. And it was really cheap. Like, Goodwill prices get a little higher every year. I was at Savers today, and most of the dresses were around $8. A William Temple House dress would be, like, maybe $3. An old school thrift store price.
I remember learning about, like, the business model of contemporary thrift stores, and it's a very smart racket.
Yeah. Look, I try not to think about the racket of thrift stores too much.
Yeah, that's very fair. I mean, it's not like it's worse than any other aspect of our stupid society.
Right.
Gotta pick our misery.
I like thrift shopping.
It's good.
And it's not morally worse than shopping at H&M or something.
Not at all. I would venture that it is slightly better.
I fucking hope. All right, next question.
Yeah. All right. This comes from BK Steve. What's behind the desire to explain media? I first noticed this around a lot of Nolan movies. I assume he means Christopher Nolan. But I doubt that started it. And how do we move beyond that artistically?
The desire to explain media?
I'm guessing that what he means is like the desire to solve media. Like to present the one true all-encompassing interpretation.
I might be wrong, but I think that Sean locates that right around True Detective season one.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's Lost. That's what his theory is. That Lost is the first like show that people felt that they were going to solve like a Rubik's Cube.
Right. Which is so funny when you think about it, because it's very obviously just a lot of random shit thrown at the wall.
I haven't watched Lost, so I'll take your word for it.
I've seen a couple of seasons. It's like a bunch of attractive people in the jungle. I don't know. I don't give a shit about it. Personally, I do think that Sean is right. I think that like the unique combination of the burgeoning social media landscape and Lost being this big runaway hit created this very weird scenario where you have all of these fans constantly theorizing and guessing. And to such an extent that the showrunners get involved and start communicating with them.
Oh, that's right. It's a social media phenomenon, too.
Right.
Like, social media didn't become so much a staple of our lives. I was going to say our online lives, but also our real lives, which are online life is real. Until, I don't know, maybe the last 10 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe 15.
I mean, I still remember Facebook coming out. I remember life before this shit.
Yeah. But even, like, for a while, it was, like, one social media thing at a time for me.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have, like, several, and those are the only sites that I go on, basically. And Wikipedia.
Right.
And Zencastr. You get the idea. Because an essential part of this game of being, of trying to figure out the show is it's social. And there's a slightly competitive aspect of having the best theory, disproving other people's theories, being vindicated, and talking about how what you theorized would happen would actually have been better than what happened.
I think, like, just in very basic dime store psychological terms, people like certainty, they like being correct, and they like to have their wishes satisfied in an uncomplicated manner, which makes fan theorizing attractive. Because even if you're wrong, like you said, you get to whine about how the show isn't as smart as you. And right. If you're right, you get to say, oh, look at me, I'm so smart, I solved the show. So it's a win-win if you're an insufferable fucking twit.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I always found it really frustrating in mysteries. Like, I liked Agatha Christie better than Sherlock Holmes, or I liked Agatha Christie's books better than books with Sherlock Holmes in them, because you can never really solve a Sherlock Holmes mystery on your own, because right. It's always like, wow, like, we went to the place, we went to the other place, a bunch of weird stuff happened, and then Sherlock Holmes was like, well, I noticed that he had a tattoo that came from Geneva, and and it's like, well, maybe if you would have told me that. It's very unfair that you can't solve it. I'm fine with that now. And in fact, I think I prefer Sherlock Holmes now. But it makes you feel smart to solve a mystery. Okay. Actually, I do have a fully baked theory about it.
Let's hear it.
Okay. So I'm always referring back to this thing that Orson Welles said about how you have to leave the audience something to do. And I usually use that in my own work to remember to not hand the story over on a platter, but let the audience involve themselves in it and participate in it in order to understand it. It's also a really sound idea in the sense that people will become more invested in something if they have included themselves in it. If you give people the opportunity to solve a puzzle, you know, like Dora the Explorer. Right. It's basically Dora the Explorer. You know, you're like, uh-oh, where's my hat? And then you have to let the audience be like, it's over there, it's on the shelf. And then you go, where? On the shelf? Wow, thanks for finding it. You know, like, that's so much more exciting for the audience than if you're just like, oh, I'm going to put on my hat, here it is on the shelf. It creates this really intense psychological bond that otherwise won't exist. And it's a really important part of media now to find ways of tricking people into having an emotional connection with the product.
Yes.
And, you know, believing that the brand is your friend or whatever. Those are the kind of feelings that you have when you get to figure out a show.
Oof. Yeah.
That's my theory.
I think it's
It's both deliberately being created by most shows in some way now. And it is doing that because they started doing it sort of by accident. And it's just really addictive to audiences.
Yeah. I mean, every time there's a new television show that generates this kind of storm of speculation, it's very lucrative for a corporation. It creates a lot of free press online, which is extremely desirable because everyone knows that that kind of press is so much more valuable than any amount of paid advertising.
That's right.
Word of mouth is so much more likely to result in, you know, your brand fighting a wider audience.
And like I said earlier, the currency is not being liked. The currency is attention. So it doesn't really matter what people are saying about it. They can be mad about their theories. They can be vindicated about their theories. As long as they're talking.
It's like it's the Game of Thrones effect.
Mm-hmm.
Even...
Why is nobody talking about Game of Thrones anymore? She said as she talked about Game of Thrones.
Yes. Just a classic type of tweet. But even people being borderline delusionally upset about the ending really just gave it more cultural currency.
Yep. I might be making stuff up, but I want to say that was a major uproar on Metafilter as well.
I'm sure.
Because the Daenerys phenomenon and the Hillary phenomenon are linked in my mind now.
Yes. Yes. I think that is completely true. And I think it exposed this huge fault line in how people think about women with power.
Uh-huh. Yeah, whole, like, notorious RBG thing happened around the same time, too.
Right. It was sort of the peak of this newest wave of girl boss-ism, which is just the most repulsive thing imaginable. It's saying that the most amazing thing you can do as a girl is to participate in violent, heteropatriarchal capitalism in the exact same way men do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just so self-evidently hollow and pointless and awful and evil. And so with Daenerys and that whole storyline coming to a head around the same time that things are at such a fever pitch with, you know, everyone's opinion on Hillary, where do you stand vis-a-vis Hillary and Bernie and all that, and this sort of hyper-personal brand of electoral politics.
And in the face of this thing that everybody could agree sucked in every way, which is Trump being president.
Right.
Like, there's nothing to say about it. It's just obviously very bad. Nobody liked it.
Right.
Except for rich assholes that we don't care about. Those people deserve the guillotine.
Yes.
So everybody, every side of the, like, Dems versus liberals versus leftists arguments is always like, oh, so you want Trump to win then?
Oh my god. It's all so, like, bought into the idea that there's nothing outside of electoral politics. But
this is
anyway.
Not my strong suit. I don't think we should talk about this.
Also, just fuck it. It's boring.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was that I think a lot of people, when Daenerys's story went in the inevitable, heavily foreshadowed, incredibly well built up direction that it went in, felt that the show had not conformed to the ending that they had in their minds, you know, their solution of Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
which is that Daenerys makes, like, Aragorn from Lord of the Rings and takes the throne, and, like, maybe it's a little bloodier than that, but ultimately she's a force for limited but unqualified good.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, when art doesn't do exactly what people want, it has become sort of de rigueur to treat it like the art is assaulting you in your home. So I think that there's this sort of bottle feeding mentality that goes along with solving art in sort of the post Game of Thrones media landscape too. A lot of people want art not just to comfort them, but never to discomfort them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is contemptible, but I'm not very nice. So
I think it's important to cultivate a certain amount of comfort with ambiguity.
Yes.
Both in real life and in your consumption of art, you have to be able to live with the idea that not everything can be understood, and not everything can be understood by you in particular.
Right.
And it doesn't need to be. It's very difficult to accept, and in fact, it's horrifying if you think about it, that everybody else in the world has minds that are complex as yours, and you will never know them.
Right.
You'll never fully understand any other person.
There's a fundamental gulf between all human experiences.
And it's horrible to think about. When you experience something with another person, you are not having an identical experience. And you can't necessarily convince somebody to have had the experience that you had. In fact, you can't do that at all. And these are things in life that are fundamentally unresolvable. Most things you will never know.
Yes.
And you really have to learn to live with that.
You just do. And I think that another facet of this is learning to accept that even when you do understand or solve something, that's not automatically a meaningful process that will change anything or make anything better.
It might be better if you don't. Last week I watched Lost Highway for like the 100th time. And could I tell you what Lost Highway is about? Like, could I describe the plot of it? I don't know. Maybe. In some ways I can. In other ways, like fundamentally, I can't. And I'm not trying to. David, I do not want to. Part of the experience of Lost Highway is this fundamentally unresolvable story.
Right. It's like someone took a traditional narrative and then smashed it and shuffled all the pieces around.
Mm-hmm. And then took some out before they gave it to you.
Yes. Yeah, I really love that about David Lynch. His movies are so sensualist. It's about having an experience, not about understanding a narrative arc.
Yep. It's all explain that. No.
Yeah. Right.
So the podcast is very against solving media. I know you're all shocked. So real surprise, Dark Horse answer.
And I guess if I had anything in the way of advice to give for moving past this artistically, first, give up on the idea that you can alter the course of public art literacy. The best thing that you can do is seek out great, ambiguous, intelligent, moving work. Maybe make it yourself if you are inclined to. And that will naturally lead to others following suit, to you meeting other people who are doing the same thing. There are communities of people who hold the same or similar values about art. And they may not be the mainstream. They may not ever be the mainstream. But that's okay.
They may not be living in your town.
Right.
You have the internet. Like, I know you do.
It's sort of like being gay. Like, mm-hmm. What do you want to be hanging out with straights and like welcome in their society? No, that shit fucking sucks. I don't want fucking Disney to internalize my ideals about fiction. That doesn't matter to me. That's not my world. And I think that more than anything is what I would give as a guidepost to getting away from solving art. Just say fuck it. Fuck all this corporate garbage and puzzle solving. It doesn't have to mean anything to you.
Most things cannot be resolved. Stories, problems, relationships, experiences. You don't get to just put a hat on stuff and be done with it in life.
Yes.
Because I always think about this when people want to have closure. The conversation about having closure after a breakup is,
oh my God,
such a scam. Because what you really want is to make the other person feel the way that you feel about what happened. And that's impossible.
Right. And
they had a different story of the relationship and they're entitled to it.
Yep. I guess saying
you do not have to match.
I would like to practice reactive attachment is a little less socially acceptable. Yeah, closure doesn't exist.
Stop trying to finish things. No, wait, that's not true. You do have to finish things.
You have to finish your art and that's all.
You have to finish your dinner.
You don't have to finish your dinner. You can eat until you're full.
That's right. Next question.
Okay. Have you ever read a negative critique of something you enjoyed or a positive one of something you didn't that was insightful enough that it still impacted your feelings or understanding of that work?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a really great review of the Little Marvin series, Them, by Twitter user, I think his name is Brandon Tyler. It was so insightful. And I loved Them. And I still do. But this review came from a perspective that I do not have access to as a white woman. And it really dug into the way that some of the show's images were sort of flattened and generalized in a way that took away from its impact. And it was so even-handed and just really, really, really penetrating that it did make me reapproach a lot of things in the show.
I can't think of a specific time when it's happened to me, but I'm sure that it happens all the time. I mean, there's a part of me that really resists being wrong about facts. If right. I put my foot down, I'm usually right about that kind of thing. But like questions of whether or not something is, I don't like to say whether or not something is good, but whether or not I like it, I love to discover that I've been wrong about that. I love to look at things in a new way. It's great. It's I don't always seek out that experience because it's a lot of work to change your mind. It's like the kind of work that a caterpillar puts into making its chrysalis. But it feels good to gain a new appreciation for something that you previously didn't like, or to find things to be critical about in something that you previously liked. I think it sucks sometimes when there's something that you love that gets spoiled for you. Because I think generally it's a net positive for the world to like things more than dislike them. I think most things in the world are likable if you try.
Yeah, it is tough when you have to deal with something that you really love and maybe that is in some way connected to your identity just because of how much time and thought you've put into emotionally connecting with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to confront something about its structure or message or whatever that is unsavory to you and doesn't mesh with your ideals. And I think that this can be a really good exercise in holding conflicting ideas and mm-hmm. in not allowing the art that you take in to dictate your ideals from like piece to piece.
Mm-hmm.
But it is work, you know, it's like mental and emotional reps.
Yeah. I really want to assume I don't exercise. I really want to recognize that like, cogitation is work. We had another question on the Discord, not to jump ahead, but I want to reference it because it ties into what I am saying. This is from Eve. It was, how do you clear your brain of the internet when offline so you have enough space in your head for creativity and thinking? Do you have specific boundaries you've set for yourself or rituals you do? Or have you just fostered a mindset that allows you to leave it behind and not take up too much space in your head? Making room in your brain for the stuff that you want to do is work.
Yes, it is.
Like, it's because like you're not moving your body or like producing anything physical, you have been convinced by the culture that you live in to believe that it is not work because it doesn't produce anything.
Which but many
thinking, thinking is really hard.
Yes, it is. And many cultures would show immediately that it is absurd not to think of cogitation as work, like every tradition of meditation around the world.
Yeah, and meditation was something that I wanted to talk about in response to that question too. I don't meditate. It's better for me to be moving to clear my brain than like to sit still. That stresses me out. But you do have to develop a practice of just not trying to push that stuff away, the horrible mm-hmm. internet or whatever, but like letting it flow through you, letting yourself chew on it and then spit it out. You have to find a way to like think yourself through it and then move past it. You've been chewing on the gum and now it's lost its flavor and you can spit it out.
That's a good way to put it.
Thank you. This is what I'm talking about with like creating a metaphor, recontextualizing. This is what I'm doing when I fictionalize.
Yeah, and this is all a form of cognitive work. Like, it's all just moving bricks around.
Yep.
Very glamorous.
I mean, it looks pretty glamorous when it is just, like, lying in bed frowning about bad sex or something.
Don't put me on blast like that.
It looks easy when you're just a crocodile lying in a bog. All right, let's really answer Eve's question and then we'll call it a night, okay?
That sounds good to me. So, first of all, this is a really good question. Thank you, Eve.
It is.
Second, to me, there are a couple of very important skills here. And this actually ties into stuff that we were talking about earlier. Not reacting is a really crucial part of this. Think of every tweet that you see or email you receive as an action. And when you process it, it's very easy to start reacting to it. You know, you see a stupid take and you get mad and then you format your own dunk on it or whatever.
You don't have to make up your mind about it. You don't have to have an opinion.
Right. You can just let it whoosh past because in 15 minutes, no one is ever going to reference it again. I mean, this stuff is nothing. It's just chaff in the wind. You can ignore it.
It's like if you're walking down the street in the city and you see somebody who's wearing a t-shirt and like you have some feelings about the shirt. You're like, oh, that's a cartoon character that I like. And you can stop and talk to that person or you can just keep walking. And there's like a million more t-shirts that you can look at.
Yes.
You can just let it flow by.
Life is huge and varied and almost all interaction is totally optional.
But I don't want to make it sound too chill because in order to, like, you really have to be protective of your poor, precious brain.
Yep.
There are assaults coming on it on every side. And you have to be really rigorous about not letting things in that are going to upset you. Or upset is the wrong word because sometimes it's fun to be upset. And sometimes it's healthy. It's a growing experience. But like things that are going to damage you to the point that you are unable to move forward.
Our experiences with being harassed online.
Yeah.
There's no benefit to our participating in that.
Yeah, you just got to open up a trap door and sneak out of that conversation.
Yep. Run.
And I think it can feel selfish to protect your boundaries when you're not used to it. It sounds very touchy-feely to say you're protecting your boundaries.
Sometimes the feelies need to be touchied.
You just have to think of your brain as like a precious plant that you are trying to help grow and get the things that it needs in order to be strong and healthy. And you have to keep it away from stuff that's going to damage it.
Right. You have to keep it clean of parasites. You have to keep it out of the sun at certain hours.
And like you have to really consciously do this. This is not just like a little thought to brighten your day and then forget about. Like you have to consciously ask yourself, like, am I engaging with the internet in a way that is going to ruin my day? Which is so easy to do.
It's so easy. Oh my God.
And you have to touch grass.
Yes.
It's touch a grass. Joke, but you really have to touch grass.
And get ass.
Yes, and get ass. Just like, you got to talk to real people. You got to go to the store and pick out the kind of fruit that you like to eat.
Mm-hmm. Turn off your fucking phone, you know?
Do real stuff.
Sometimes I get a lot of wonderful writing done when I just turn the internet off. I'm not great about this. I could probably get more done if I did it more often, but
don't do it right now because then you won't hear the rest of the podcast.
That's true. I would advise against doing that.
All right. I would like to answer the question from Desdemonical.
Let's do it.
All right. It's /did you ever have a worry that the moralizers, trademark, were right, whether the conservative Christian fueled or the liberal pearl clutching variety, and that you were somehow making the world worse with your art/existence? And if so, how did you move past that? Bold of you to assume I've moved past that. I'm not worried about those people exactly. Liberals, conservative Christians. But there are times when I think about how much better other people seem to be at handling the world, just doing normal things like feeding themselves and paying bills, styling their hair. I don't know. there's a part of me that feels fundamentally unsuited to the world and that things would run smoother without me. But like, what are you going to do?
I mean, honey, we'd all like to be dead, but you're not allowed to leave me here alone.
I know. I mean, same. The thing is that we are stuck in this trap with people that we care about. And for God's sake, for your own sanity, you have to believe that those people's feelings are real.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they're not. Maybe everybody is pretend but you. But I don't think that it will improve your existence to believe that. No. So you have to choose to believe that the people who love you might be right. As for whether or not my work should exist, I often feel that, you know, I see other people's work online. I'm like, well, I don't understand why me? Like, why are people so into my work and not everybody else on the zine Discord, for example? Like, I'm glad to have the job that I do. I don't necessarily feel that I'm the only person who could be doing it. I don't think I'm making the world worse, though. That is one thing about my job that is really important to me. Maybe the most important thing to me in a job. You know, I've worked in shops and factories and cafes, different variations of like making things to be sold and thrown away. And there's something that is so discouraging about that. It was hard for me to live with. And I'm not saying like you should feel bad if you have that kind of job, because those are kind of the only jobs that there are for people like us.
Right. Those things aren't your fault. It's just like we're all forced to participate in various miseries. I remember when I was really, 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 really poor, really the only jobs I could hold down for any length of time were copy editing and copywriting. So I would work with advertisers. And it would be these enormous bulk jobs where it's like, okay, you have to write the landing pages for 10,000 different Wikipedia searches, or not Wikipedia, eBay, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like vomiting garbage. Like, you'd look at it and you'd think, I know for a fact that the world will be a marginally worse place when I hit send.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to do it because otherwise I will have to be homeless.
So I think that out of all the jobs that exist, mine isn't necessarily, I don't think it makes the world a worse place. I think the adding to the sum total of art in the world, even if it's bad, is overall a positive thing.
That's how I feel too. And it certainly has been a huge relief to me to be able to make art my job.
And books are recyclable. They're biodegradable. You can burn them when you're done with them.
Right.
The product is not the paper. The product is the story.
That shit can just go right back to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there was a time when I did struggle with the idea that my existence and by extension, the art that I made, the things that I wrote, were immoral. I mean, I was raised in a very religious house. I was told a lot of extremely destructive stuff as a child, and it was hard to uproot that. It was very hard, and sometimes, you know, fragments of it still linger. But I think that telling a story, painting a portrait, those aren't really things that make or break reality. It's not where morality comes from or dies. They can be beautiful, important things. They can be kind of insignificant. Any number of spectra in between. But I don't think that, no part of me worries that the moralizers are right anymore. I've met and spoken with these people, and they are hollow and contemptible. They have nothing to offer.
Right on.
Making art is what I love. That's enough reason for me. And like you said, man, at least it's not a bomb.
One thing about being an artist for a job is that you probably will never be stranded in the Pacific Ocean and eaten by a shark.
That's very true, but what you failed to consider is the emotional struggle that results in as I try to write my new book about being stranded in the ocean and eaten by a shark.
Oh, you wish you had that firsthand experience.
Right. It's like, it's not fair that other people get to go and get stranded in the Pacific Ocean and eaten by sharks. Because I'm here communicating that reality, and I just feel like they're not appreciating it.
Actually, I think I would give it up for the opportunity to be stranded in the ocean and eaten by a shark.
Yeah, of course you would.
No, but like, writing things down is all well and good, but like, what is your life for if you're not like having some fucking experiences? What is your body for if it's not being ripped up and eaten by a shark?
I think that there are a lot of experiences between sitting down and writing and being eaten by a shark.
No.
Oh, there aren't? Uh-uh. Wow. That's crazy to learn.
Which one will do?
If that's like a process like 2 plus 2 equals 4, 4 plus 4 equals 8, what comes after getting eaten by the shark? Like the fucking end of 2001 or something?
They deliver the bomb?
Wow.
Oh!
Good drop. Good drop, Juge.
Thanks. All right. You've been listening to the Lament Configuration Podcast. You can find us on all the podcast platforms of your choice. You know that because you're already listening to us. Leave us a 5-star review or a 0-star review, but preferably a 5-star review on iTunes. Join the Discord. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Maybe we'll link it when we post this.
Yeah. Get on in here.
Come on in.
The water's full of sharks.
Yeah, I was going to say there's no sharks, but there's actually several.
There's so many sharks.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.